But if you don't take me back, Diana, leave all of my mind.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 23rd of July. A delight, as always, to have you with us. And let me introduce the panel to you. Just a quick note, Rory Block is the beautiful voice you just heard singing. She's being featured at the Rory Block Gospel and Blues Fest at PS21 in Chatham this Thursday through Sunday. And it goes the 25th through the 28th, and you can find out more at ps21chatham.org. And you can find the playlist posted on our website. So the great Rory Block playing Chatham this Thursday through Sunday, and you can see the entire schedule on our website or by going to ps21chatham.org, and we'll be playing Rory throughout the morning. Let me introduce the panel to you, and we'll get started. We have a lot to discuss. Some days I just sit by that computer and look and think, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to talk about? And then yesterday I did it in about 3 minutes because there's a billion stories, and we have wonderful people to talk about them. So let's get started. Skidmore College business professor and Brexit expert Peter Maloney is with us because you may have heard there's a new prime minister in the UK, and we want to talk about that. So, Peter, welcome back to the program. Very nice to have you here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo joins us. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
Edward Hamilton, distinguished professor of computer science and RPI and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Page two, and a Harvard Data Science Initiative fellow, Fran Berman. Good morning, Fran.
That's way too long of an introduction. Now, well, good morning.
I'll work with you to tighten it up, but it sounds
say
great.
Generally,
I'll take some of them. Cool.
You want to take the
I
Harvard
got two
part?
Words. I want two or three of hers.
How about generally cool person, Fran Berman?
There you go. Yeah. And the best, J.P. Miller is here from the Empire Report. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here, as always. WMC's Alan Chartok joins us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, and to quote Rosemary, good morning.
Yes.
It's memorable lines, all.
Yes. Well, it's good to have you all here. We welcome your letters, of course, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind. Regarding
one thing is on my mind is doesn't Boris Johnson look a little like a what do you call us like a send off on Trump? I mean, he looks like a sort of
caricature.
Yes, a caricature of Trump.
Boris Johnson, Britain's. Now, first of all, I have to say the only reason I'm really excited about Boris Johnson being named prime minister or voted in as prime minister is because he's been on our show.
Other than is that, right? What did you interviewed him
when
on
he
a
was
book?
When he was mayor of London? He came yes. on and did the show.
What was he wearing, Joe?
And what was he pushing? Was he pushing a book?
You know what? I don't even remember. I think he was just in the States for some reason.
He was here.
Yeah, he wasn't in the studio. He was in New York.
And do you remember anything stand out
maybe,
from it?
Maybe we'll try to find it.
Maybe the Olympic Games. And
yeah, or I don't really know exactly
no,
what
you
it
should,
was.
You should definitely find
we'll
it.
We'll find
yes.
it. So Boris Johnson, Britain's brash former foreign secretary, on Tuesday won the contest to succeed Prime Minister Theresa May, with his party handing the job of resolving the country's three-year Brexit nightmare to one of the architects of the project and one of the country's most polarizing politicians. Mr. Johnson beat Jeremy Hunt, his successor as foreign secretary, in the battle for the leadership of Britain's governing Conservative Party, winning 66% of the postal vote held among its membership. Although the Conservatives' working majority in Parliament is very small, it appears to be enough to ensure that Mr. Johnson will succeed Mrs. May as prime minister on Wednesday. So
CNN just had them both on, both Trump and Boris Johnson together, and he really looks like sort of Me Too Junior. Boris Johnson standing next to him. He looks like a, you know, like a caricature of the president.
Well, so, you know, we certainly need more of that, don't we? So, Peter, let us go to Peter Maloney. Let's go to you as our Brexit expert, and you with the British accent and all.
Maybe Irish accent.
Oh, Irish. That's great. That's right. You do have an Irish accent. Where did you grow up again?
Ireland.
I know Ireland. Where in Ireland?
West of Ireland, Limerick.
Oh, in Limerick. So even
where the poem comes from.
Okay.
I knew a young man from Limerick.
There you go.
just keep going, Alan.
He sounds like a fake Irish guy to me.
All right. So not a shock, right, that Boris Johnson is. I mean, I think you called this several months ago.
Yeah, and I wasn't exceptional in doing that. It's the worst kept secret for, at this stage, 6 weeks. It's pretty desperate times, and in desperate times, desperate choices,
right.
And he is giving them, the party members, what they want to hear. Doesn't mean that in reality he can deliver, but for now they think he's the guy to bring them Brexit and to bring them to keep them in government effectively.
So it's Brexit at all costs. In other words,
yeah, his phrase is do or die. Halloween is the new deadline, and
that's funny.
His phrase was do or die. Effectively, we get a deal by then and we accept it, or we have a no deal Brexit and we get on with it, which is a pretty exceptional thing for a leader to say, considering it's a pretty strong self-inflicted wound.
Well, you don't think of a politician ever saying of having die be an option.
Well, this is, I mean, he's got a great way with words, and he often gets himself in deep trouble.
That would be great in air quotes, right?
Yeah, no. He's entertaining. You have to admit, he's entertaining. He's flamboyant. He's kind of everyone's darling. Despite his politics, he's actually entertaining.
So does he have the cojones to do it? In other words, yes.
I don't know. I think Boris is more about Boris the brand than Britain or anybody else, or even his party. If the choice is saving his own skin and throwing the country or the party under the bus, he's probably going to go for his own skin.
So, Peter, what are the specifics of, you know, his ideal Brexit? You know, what happens to trade and what happens to all of the policy and legal agreements? And does GDPR cover them anymore? And you know,
I mean, he, again, that's kind of one of the heads of the Leave campaign. He was one of the masterminds of the whole thing. But now he has to actually deliver it. Up to now, he's been in government, but not prime minister. He's been out in the wilderness a little bit. But now he actually has to, the buck stops with him. And he literally may live or die based on his decisions. But I think, realistically, the deal that was on the table is the only deal that the European Union will contemplate, even though he and Hunt during the election campaign consistently said they would renegotiate, get better terms. But the EU has said deal's done.
So for the average citizen of the United Kingdom, first of all, what's the sense of his popularity among the people of?
Well, it depends where you go. He is popular among the people who just elected him are 160,000 party members who are predominantly older, male. See where I'm going here? White,
yes.
You know, background, and that's the kind of people he appeals to.
So the suburbs of Philadelphia and Michigan and Wisconsin.
Okay. Everything that you're saying is transferable. Keep going.
Yeah, I know. It's weird.
Yeah,
I feel
the
like
resemblance is way past.
It's kind of crazy. Yeah, but one thing about him is that there is a genuine risk that he's very polarizing. So he's popular among certain groups in his own party, but he is absolutely hated by the Labour Party, by Scottish people, by people in Ireland. He's very much an English politician.
And by a lot of people in his party. I mean,
correct.
Yeah. Resignation.
Yeah, there's
so
been that.
Are we
before
see them
he even came in,
off?
Before he even came in, they were running for the door just to probably avoid being fired, but also just to put their mark down. We will not allow you to destroy all this. And if there's a no deal Brexit, we will in Parliament try to block it.
So are we going to see Scotland breaking off and things like that?
It depends. If there's a no deal Brexit, then that is a fundamentally ground-changing circumstance that in 2014, when the Scots narrowly remained in the UK, it was the ground line for the Scottish government was if there's a fundamental change in our relationship with Europe, then that's the grounds for another referendum. And whether it would pass or not is another thing, but it's the fact that it's going that direction. And also Northern Ireland, as part of the Good Friday Agreement, there is a an option to have a united Ireland, which, again, is probably not going to happen soon, but we're talking about it, which we were not talking about up to 3 years ago.
So if he's hated, so let me just focus on Ireland for a moment. So if he's hated, and if there is a... If there is a hard just exit, what does Ireland do?
Good question. They're pretty very concerned about it because it is predominantly the border area is predominantly a rural area, and it's becoming extremely integrated in the past 20 years since the end of the Troubles, and in many senses it is a single market, but it's a single entity. And reintroducing a border, whether it just be individuals checking your car or cameras, will A, cause all kinds of trouble because it's adding costs to doing business over the border, and B, just be a target for those who used to be involved in more, shall I say, paramilitary politics to target. So it's, and this is where Johnson is a bit cavalier. He puts great faith in technology and we can find the solution kind of thing. But the reality on the ground is that he's very ignorant of what's actually happening in Northern Ireland.
Peter,
I'm not sure he's been there, actually.
You know, one question I think for U.S. people
But he can
is,
find it on a map, right? Okay, go ahead.
Maybe.
What's the impact for the U.S.? And a snarkier version of that question is, you know, why should Trump's base care about Brexit?
Well... The impact for the U.S. is Britain has been, as you know, the special relationship has been a key ally for generations, and they've always been a force within the European Union to keep the Europeans from being a little bit. They tend to gravitate towards more a welfare social socialist approach, mm-hmm. whereas Britain has been sort of the Atlantic neoliberal influence, and the single market, which is the crown jewel of the European Union at this stage. Was a British creation, effectively. The idea of lowering tariffs, eliminating barriers to trade.
Yeah.
It's a British brainchild. It was Margaret Thatcher's brainchild. So if they do leave it a no-deal Brexit specifically, it will disrupt trade enormously. And American firms, for example, who have bases in Britain, and there are many of them, will, in theory, no longer be able to sell those goods or those services freely with the rest of Europe.
And that includes Ireland, right? Because Ireland is the base of a lot of U.S. companies.
Correct, yeah. I mean, it will continue between Ireland and Europe because we're still a member.
Yeah.
But those American firms who have representation in City of London is a great example of financial heart of Europe. It's no one knows. I mean, but the consensus is that it's going to be chaotic.
Okay.
Putin is sitting in the Kremlin today with mimosas celebrating with his cabinet. He is the happiest man in the world. He now has the two major Western democracies in chaos with more coming, led by amoral, demagogic, non-policy, just kind of idiots. And his power is consolidated. This is his dream.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much he was responsible, if anything, but it's kind of happened... Often domestically, it's happened organically.
Yeah.
I mean, Brexit has been boiling for several years, and it's very much...
Well, you're of course talking about the intervention.
I'm talking about the intervention in both places. I think we continue to overlook
sure.
that, and they're
yep.
still doing it. Nothing has been happened because of the demagogues in charge now in both countries, who fired the British ambassador to the U.S.
Well, this is interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because Kim Darroch was the British ambassador whose notes leaked to the press. And I'm pretty sure every ambassador in the history of the world has said bad things about the country they're in. That's their job. But their job is to keep it private. It just got out, created a storm. And this is where Johnson's influence comes in. He wasn't even prime minister yet. And in a debate, he refused to back the British ambassador for what he said. And the British ambassador took that as a signal that, you know what, Boris is probably going to win, and I'm out anyway, so I may as well leave.
So we've been dancing around this a little bit, but the direct question in the 2 minutes before we go to a break, which is, so what does this mean for the relationship between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson?
Well, romance.
Well, the irony is that 3 years ago...
Bromance or romance?
Both. Either way.
Okay. Yeah.
I feel like they're like twins separated at birth.
Yeah.
With like maybe 30 years difference. But yeah, I mean, the irony is that up to 3 years ago, Johnson was seen as being... He was the mayor of London. He was elected by London, which is one of the most liberal sections in Britain. And yet now he's become this ultra-conservative character, which kind of suggests really he's after his own. He's looking after his own. And as for Trump, I think they see certain things eye to eye. But Boris is a chameleon. He will do what is necessary. Well, I guess yeah. I guess they are kind of more similar than we might think. So
that's the man who supported, you know, the Clintons and abortion, and now look at him.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, there would be appreciation for Boris's art form here.
Yeah, people will be aware of I mean, skills. Americans are very aware of this, what's happening in Britain, because it kind of resembles a lot of issues that are happening over here.
Well, to use a word that I love and that Fran has already used, to be snarky for a moment.
Okay, let's be snarky.
You know, you do wonder how long that romance is going to last. And they both have the penchant of kind of screwing that up. One person's going to say something about the other, and then they're going to go
to a
snit,
be like
right?
A gaffe.
I knew the bachelorette would come in here somewhere. I knew it.
Who's going to get the rose?
It's going to be like a gaff tennis game between the two of them back and forth with serious consequences beyond themselves. And I think there's an Iranian situation happening. Obviously, a British tanker was taken recently, and the Americans have effectively, Pompeo said, effectively, you're on your own. And if that's the future relationship between Britain and the US, while the UK are breaking away from Europe, it kind of leaves them pretty isolated in the future, because they can't rely on the U.S. for consistent support.
Is Brexit the key issue over there? Are there other? What are the other big divisive issues that he uses? Immigration.
Up during the referendum, that was part of it, but not if Brexit is. I say it happened. It hasn't happened. They're just talking about it and they're negotiating it. Brexit sucks the air out of the room for everything else. This Iranian issue, Johnson will not really have the time to dedicate to it, because he's got to deal with a short timetable, huge amount of negotiation, and it's for 3 years it has sucked the air out of the room on health, education, everything else has just gone by the wayside.
We have to take a break, but there is something just fascinating. You call an election, you have the election, and then he'll be in office, and I mean, there is something...
Democracy, right?
Something cool. Like,
the result is the same, though. So
no, that's
no
true.
No longer in favor of parliamentary government, either.
What are you in favor of?
Boy, you... I have to go to a break. We'll be right back.
What am I in favor of?
We ain't got time for hate. Well, we actually have about 48 minutes to dance around it anyway here. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue, J.P. Miller. Peter Maloney is here, Fran Berman, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Chartok. We do have letters, and this one from June, who says, hey, did you know that Boris was born in New York City in 1964? I did know that.
He gave up his citizenship two or three years ago, but technically he could have become president, I guess. He qualified as an American-born citizen.
He gave up his citizenship?
He gave it up. I'm not sure why, but maybe to...
Prime Minister?
Well, I think you could... He's British as well, so he could have been Prime Minister anyway, but I'm not quite sure why he gave it up.
So I wonder if he could come back and run for president if he became a citizen.
Well, he's given it up now, so
what,
I think
the real world isn't
he's
scary enough?
natural-born citizen. He's natural-born.
It's true.
He was born in 1964. Trump was 18 at the time. Just saying, says
just
June.
Just saying.
Thank you for your expert this morning. That's you, Peter.
Oh, thank you.
That said,
is that
I
my
work...
wife?
Yeah. Is your wife's name Carol?
No, it's not.
Okay, then you're free to go. That said, I worry about the future of the UK Union. Scotland recently barely stayed in the UK, and if Boris succeeds in Brexit deal or no deal, is Scotland fated for leaving the UK? ? And what about Northern Ireland? Back to the Troubles? ?
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, what I will say is that the Scottish situation is a real concern for after 300 years of a single Kingdom, that they will push for independence. On the Irish side, the irony is that we've, until 2016, we've had perhaps the best decade or two of relations between Britain and Ireland mm-hmm. in I don't know, generations and hundreds of years. And that's being jeopardized significantly by what's happening at the moment, unfortunately.
Okay, so tell me again what England gets out of Brexit. What's the advantage that everyone supported this or a small majority?
Part of it is control of the borders. Part of it is retaining sovereignty. And part of it is just the good old-fashioned English nationalism that's resurging. Now, sovereignty is interesting because it's often pooled in the European Union for the sake of having a significance globally, to have a voice, because no one's going to listen to you if you're just 60 million people. But if you're 500 million people, then you get a voice.
Right.
Britain is voluntarily detaching itself from that, but still hoping to remain a global force, which personally I don't think is going to be the case, but who knows. But it seems, I'm kind of struggling to find the positives in it. In theory, they'll be able to control their own laws and borders and stuff, but they still have to trade with their neighbors, and that involves being part of their market in some way, and that involves taking rules from abroad.
So basically, you can keep out the immigrants. That's the main thing.
You can't even, well, yeah, in theory, but they can't necessarily even, I mean, the problem is you have the European immigrants who are legally entitled to move to all the countries in Europe, and there's like 3 million in Britain. And you have immigrants from outside of the EU who have come to Britain, and that's often caused problems. But they tend to be conflated, and they're two very distinct groups. And the immigration debate during the referendum conflated them, and you had a mix of resentment to immigrants, racism, all the usual kind of things that come into it. And that was a strong force in the referendum.
I mean, one thing that's useful for our listeners to think about, and we certainly thought about this from the digital perspective, but if you think about the European Union and laws in the European Union, it introduces what we think of as federal laws, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Europe starts at a much more heterogeneous place. It's like if you map that onto the U.S., it's like if Arkansas had its own money and its own language, and that was different from Florida's or California's or, you know, North Dakota's. And so the European Union ideally is supposed to sort of harmonize all those differences so they can get economies of scale, you know, economics, law, federal, and from the digital point of view, which is something we look at, you know, in my bailiwick, you know, everybody is building their own internet, and the digital rights laws differed from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And because the European Union came together, there's really a very strong and actually quite progressive digital rights agenda, which includes the General Data Protection Regulation,
correct, yeah.
GDPR.
Yeah. So it's definitely what countries have done in Europe has in European Union has given the Court of Justice or the Commission centralized power to deal with, for example, only the Commission negotiates trade deals with other countries. Germany doesn't, France doesn't. It's all pooled together with the Commission because it's more effective and more efficient. But the decision still has to be passed by the heads of state.
Yeah.
But the negotiation is done by the Commission or the civil service of the European Union. Britain has great plans to open itself to the world, globalize its economy. In this environment, that's a question.
Yeah.
But they also have had nobody who's negotiated trade deals for 40 years.
Yeah.
Because they've delegated it to Europe.
Yeah.
So you got a problem there of ability and intent, and they don't seem to match up.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. I come from California, and you can, you know, get in a car in California and drive 12 hours and still be in California. And, you know, now that I've been living in the Northeast for a while, it's like, you know, it's weird. You know, you get in a car and you drive for 2 hours and you've been in three states. But imagine if you had to have a different passport for each of those states.
Yeah.
And each of those states had different money and a different language. And that's been the situation in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, until, you know, the European Union is harmonizing that a bit.
Yeah, and it's usually based on democratic consensus among the member states. And this is part of the problem, too, in Britain and other countries. If a decision was taken years ago to pool sovereignty. It was taken on their behalf by their heads of state.
Yeah.
So it wasn't imposed on them by Brussels. And this is where national governments tend to scapegoat the EU a little bit.
Yeah.
The EU has got its own issues for sure.
For sure.
But it's always been a convenient scapegoat for less popular measures, yeah. Like fiscal discipline or whatever, right. Whatever else. So, yeah. Politics is complicated.
Yeah. Very complicated.
Very complicated. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will return and we'll head up on some. Well, actually, I have one quick question before we go to the break. That's right. I just came back to my mind. I lost it and then it came back. The one thing I was going to ask you about is when it seems that the whatever happens that. We're. It seems like the UK, as well as all of us. I mean, we're asking this question in this country: of even if the Democrats sweep in 2020, how long will it be to put things back together? Now, obviously, the situation is much more exacerbated in the UK. But let's say Boris Johnson gets everything he wants.
Mm-hmm.
That's still going to create. That's a lot of. Problems for that are going to ripple for a very, very long time.
You mean in a negotiation with Europe? Yeah, I mean
the impact is not going to be something that's going to be fixed.
Oh no, I mean in the long term you could put together a plan where Britain survives and eventually thrives, but the short to medium term is really rocky, especially with a no deal, and also some of the things that he's been aspiring to are pie in the sky. I mean, the deal has been, the British government signed off on a deal after a year and a half, and now he's trying to revisit it, which if anything kind of undermines British credibility in future with any other country negotiating a deal. We can't trust these people because they've signed the deal, their prime minister signed off, and they've now reneged on it. That's not the basis for future trade negotiations.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah, we did that a few times, didn't we?
Around
NATO.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll return. We'll go to other topics. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
It rained 40 days, 40 nights, stop. No, we're not wearing when the water can't stop it. Don't settle in the spring.
Music we're hearing is by artists featured at Rory Block's Gospel and Blues Fest at PS21 in Chatham, New York, this Thursday through Sunday, PS21Chatham.org. More letters, and then we'll move on. Please do not forget it was Steve Bannon in Cambridge Analytica is the subject who fueled Brexit and Farage, and without whom, my bet is it would not have happened. Don't miss the new documentary, The Great Hack, to be reminded of how.
Yeah, I think Farage is an important character here because the UKIP party, which was Farage's party, literally stole votes from the Conservatives in huge numbers up to 2016. They were then disbanded because their job was done. They got a successful referendum. And since then, the Conservatives have been struggling to get voters back from UKIP or from the far right. And Johnson, they see as the man who can do it, who can take back votes that were taken by Farage. And that would explain a little bit of why they've shifted to the right for that purpose.
And thank you, listener, for this reminder that we are living the digital life.
Have you seen The Great Hack?
I haven't. I want to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Richard writes and says, I'd wager Boris Johnson gave up his U.S. citizenship because he was obligated to file U.S. taxes every year, regardless as to whether he ever worked or lived in the United States. And then Jamie says the reasons for Brexit, the real reason is pure delusional insanity. Britain believes that they will become one of the world's reserve currency and thus return the empire to power. This will not happen. The pound is slave to the dollar and will continue to be no matter what they do with Brexit.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, certain aspects are delusional. It's very much an echo chamber in London compared to what's happening in Europe. And some things they're looking for are definitely impossible to give them. Fundamentally, they're looking to control their borders, but to keep their borders open for trade, which is a real, you know, good luck if you can square that circle.
Now, what's the Facebook currency called again? They're introducing their own currency now?
Yeah.
We have Bitcoin, we have Facebook currency, we have all kinds of things.
Can we have too much?
Yeah.
Facebook credits. Is that it?
Oh, no.
Facebook Libra.
Yeah, maybe.
Libra.
Libra.
Yeah.
Spawns a wave of fakes. Okay. Let's move on to some other things and talk about these issues. We got a budget deal. Federal budget. Why are you all? Are you scoffing? Was that scoffing I heard?
Yeah, this is the kind of budget deal I want in my own finances. Okay, let's keep spending. Don't worry about the future. Yeah, we have debt. Okay, we'll worry about that later.
White House and congressional negotiators reached an accord on a two-year budget on Monday that would raise spending by $320 billion over existing caps and allow the government to keep borrowing. Most likely averting a fiscal crisis, but splashing still more red ink on an already surging deficit. Alan.
Well, the question, of course, is who's paying for this? We are. This is obviously you're paying the vigorish on it. You're going to pay for the interest rate, and we know that if we're doing that, there are things that we can't pay for, and I think that's what this is all about. And then the other thing is who's in on the game? Who gets the money? You know, there's always banks, there's always agents, there are always people like that. And I think, the secret negotiations that must have been going on may have had to do with that also.
So JP just accused me of always smiling, which is a lot of the time, but not always. And so I will give the upbeat, out there remark, which is three words, silver lining. The three words are bipartisan compromise negotiation. This used to be normal, that you got a bipartisan compromise negotiation. We haven't seen one of those in a really, really, really long time.
Yeah.
But
we're
being.
Yeah, no, it's not good. It's not good. We're being sold out. I mean, somebody is going to have to pay for that. And Fran, I agree.
That's the cloud. This is only the silver lining.
Well, I'll take the cloud in this case is what we are going to have to pay for this. And yeah. when it comes to the two parties agreeing on that, that chills me more than anything else, to tell you the truth.
Yeah,
because there's always what we don't know.
I'm super scared that this is the one thing that they agreed on, that we're now going to have a $1 trillion deficit every year.
1.3. 1.3.
It's huge.
2.7 trillion over 2 years. Our total deficit is 22 trillion overall. Defense spending alone, we're going to now spend 700 billion a year, which is like double what they were spending during the Bush years.
Yeah.
And
I'm not a fan.
Right. I would think that it would be hard to print $700 billion and light it on fire over here. I mean, how do they spend that money so quick? And we're not in a major war right now. And the Republicans run on we're the deficit hawks. We are about fiscal responsibility, and they cut taxes and raise spending. It's one thing to raise spending and raise taxes, which is of course what we all have to do.
Right.
But the Republicans cut taxes and raise spending at the same thing. I think it's terrible.
Yeah.
So JP, why does Trump agree to this? What's in it for him now?
He's not. We all know he's not a real Republican.
Yeah, but what's in it for him immediately?
Well, the stock market's up 0.4% today. I imagine the stock market's going to do well, and he does. This is not a battle that helps him win the spending. He doesn't help him. He likes the immigration battle. He likes the trade battle. Those he believes helps him in the swing states. This battle doesn't help him in the swing states.
And because
inevitably,
shut up. It comes down to the end of, right? It comes down to closing down the government. And that is something he now realizes he can't even fool with anymore.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I agree with you, Alan. I think that, it saves him from having to shut down the government for the next 2 years and annoy the voters.
Just before an election.
Just before an election, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was probably a key point of what Mnuchin wanted, was put this off until after 2020.
Yeah.
What did Pelosi get from it, though?
Well, good question.
Well, you got to read the fine print. I'm sure there's, you know, pork barrel spending for
that's
all the congressmen,
what I'm
all
saying.
The senators. They're
right.
All the defense contractors. They all get their slice to
okay,
secure
that's
the
your
vote.
Assignment.
No,
well, that's right, but
thing.
who gets what? I mentioned that before because in addition to the overall philosophy of this, there are individuals who are going to make out like bandits as a result of this, and we don't know who they are.
I also think that Pelosi and McConnell don't see the battle as a battle that helps them on either side. It's kind of a battle that doesn't – if they were to go to battle on spending, on raising the debt ceiling, it wouldn't help either party. It wouldn't help the president. So they said, let's put it off. Let's all fight on immigration, trade, health care, education. And we all think we're winning that battle. So let's stick with those
which
issues.
Which are less abstract. There's money is quite, in those quantities, is quite distant, quite above people's heads. But immigration and trade are very real things that impact people's lives.
Yeah.
They sure are, and I hope you guys have seen this morning's most disturbing poll, which shows that ever since Trump has done the racist tweets, his popularity has risen in the United States of America, identifying that there is a significant 44%, you know, of the people approve of the way Trump is carrying on. And this other thing that we're talking about now hardly counts to him in the way in which his popularity is being judged.
Yeah, this is not surprising. An increasing number of studies have pointed to a vote for Trump is outright or overt agreement with his racist policies, anti-immigration and racist policies. So,
well, his numbers.
Again, the liberal bias against who Trump supporters are appears to be holding up empirically.
But I'm still completely mystified by this because everybody's an immigrant. Unless you're a Native American, you're an immigrant to this country. Wow. So, you know, how does this even make sense?
It's perceptions,
the
though,
perception
maybe.
Is. Yeah. Perception is. You're not an immigrant if you've been here for one generation.
Exactly. But, and that includes people in Congress. So, you know.
Yeah, no. That, but in Marco all honesty, Rubio. Fran, it's sort of a goo-goo, foo-foo argument. Which is, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Is that a technical term?
Not familiar with goo-goo, foo-foo.
Yeah, goo-goo, foo-foo. Is that a technical term?
A couple more years in this country, you'll get it.
Yeah, yeah. It is. In political science, we know it for years. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know that it is abhorrent. Nevertheless, that's just the way it is in this country.
I'll also point out that his approval rating on the day he was elected was 37% when he was elected. So he's now 7 points above the day he was elected after being in office for how long now? 2 years?
And
yeah, but you know I'm a data scientist, so I want to see the data. You know, how was the question phrased? Who were the, you know, what is the sample of people that they asked?
Approval's pretty easy, though. Do you approve of Donald Trump or the performance of the president? Approval's, that's not a...
Okay, but if we want to be specific about, you know, what does this have to do with his policies or his racism and stuff like that, you know, there are questions and there are ways you frame it. I mean, one of the, you know, think about the election models when he got elected. And, you know, a lot of them said that Hillary Clinton was going to get elected. And, you know, why is that true? Were they just crappy models? Well, sometimes the data was crappy. Sometimes it was interpreted crappy. Sometimes the questions were crappy. There were a lot of different reasons. And
but
so,
let's remember, she
you
got
know,
more
for
votes.
Me, I just want to understand. I don't want to just think it's a poll, so it's right. I want to understand what the poll actually asked.
Well, I think that the polls, too, have a tough time asking people, hey, what do you really like about him? Or, do you love those tweets that he's sending out, that, you know, the racist tweets? And people aren't on the phone going to say, yes, that's why I'm now approving of him, is because he's taking on the squad. You know, it's tough to poll these controversial issues. And I do think we're getting bad information out of the polls.
Well, but if you're going to consider that evidence, you know, the evidence ought to be...
Seriously. We get it. However, there are comparisons to be made. We've been polling on this level of Fran all along, and now he's rising in those very comparative polls that we've been taking. I, for one, it scares me to death that there are that many Americans who buy the lie.
Are you saying that the 44% is then kind of the hidden amount? I mean, there may be more who just don't want to admit
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, J.P. Miller, Fran Berman, Rosemary Armeo, and Peter Maloney make up the group. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Well, now the sky is so gray and cloudy.
Good morning, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A lot of stuff to talk about. One of the things that we want to discuss, of course, is the Mueller hearings that will be happening tomorrow, as we were planning on taking those tomorrow. And we want to so there was a little wrench thrown in yesterday where the Justice Department sought to tightly hem in this week's congressional testimony by the former special counsel Robert Mueller, telling him in a letter that he must remain within the boundaries of the public version of his report on the Russia investigation. The department also told Mueller that he could not, quote, discuss the conduct of uncharged third parties, you know, like the president, his family, and his closest associates, nor could he discuss, quote, the redacted portions of the public version of his report. Alan.
Don't get me wrong. Brexit is, of course, a huge story, and I'm delighted and grateful that we have our guest this morning. We spent a lot of good time on it. Nevertheless, the Mueller hearings could be the beginning of the end or not. It is clear.
No way.
No way, says Rosemary, just in case you didn't hear her. So,
that was supposed to be under my breath.
Yeah, no, I know. My mother was an expert in that, too. She could speak under her breath
yeah,
so you could hear
it. Understand that.
So she could hear it, so we could all hear it. Nevertheless, the Mueller hearings could be very important. Now, what's interesting to me is the fact that the president is clearly scared to death. They're giving him all kinds of warnings. Don't talk about anything. Don't say anything that you might know. To me, that is an indication that something is really, really up here. This could be the future of the way in which this country operates, because if these hearings disclose material that had not been disclosed before, I watched Jerry Nadler on CNN this morning. I thought, and by the way, I've never been a big fan, but he was superb. I mean, he was superb in the way he answered the questions, in what he was after, in his conclusions that he had found. So I think these Mueller hearings have the potential, although I'm with Rosemary that they probably won't, but they have the potential for breaking wide open.
I think the new letter from the Justice Department, which apparently was solicited by Mueller himself, gives him the excuse that he needed, as if he needed it. He's already been reluctant enough. I don't think he's going to say anything.
It certainly is possible, Rosemary, but what do you make of the fact that this president keeps after Mueller in the worst, meanest kind of ways, and that Mueller doesn't fight back? I mean, to me, that is so fascinating.
Well, I think it's a great lesson that AOC and the squad should pick up on.
So, Alan, they had some people on one of the talk shows last night who knew him well, and have worked with him. And their opinion is that, you know, he doesn't really want to testify. He wants the report to speak for himself.
Well, he said that.
You know, we're not going to see any fireworks or drama or, you know, that he, by his own personality and discipline, is not inclined really sort of give us anything that would provide that kind of breakthrough. Yeah. It was an interesting point of view.
No, but that is the accepted. Look, he said so himself. Nevertheless, if you listen to Nadler this morning, what his intentions are, and they're role-playing this, they get 5 minutes, which is not much each. So what they're doing is they're giving specific questions that relate to the report itself. On page 67, you said, what did this mean? What does this mean? And he could say, you're quite right, friend. You know, two tough nuggies. You know, read the report.
Okay, so, Alan, here's the thing. Yes. He starts at 8:30 tomorrow. How many, I will be glued to my TV set.
Sure.
How many Americans are going to be there saying, oh, Mueller's on, I got to hear him read the report? come on.
Well, the media.
This is a liberal wet dream that he's going to be up there and everything changes.
Hello.
It is. It is. Come on. It's just
exciting.
It's crazy.
No. I understand, Rosemary. I understand what you're saying.
Alan, here's my question to you. Here's my question to you.
Yeah. Rosemary, why nocturnal emission? Go ahead.
Okay, nocturnal emission. Okay.
I knew he'd get to the technical.
I was inspired by Donald Trump to say what I really think. You know, that's a good thing.
You did not need to be inspired by Donald Trump. You've been doing it all along.
Okay, here's the question. Why? Why does Mueller not want to testify? Why is he letting Barr lead the spin? What's his... Why have we turned him into a hero?
Put another way, what do they have on him? And you know, that is a very profound question, Rosemary. It really is, because it's so clear that, you know, he's a guy of integrity. At least that's what we've heard along, and he should be able to stand up and clobber the guy for what he's been doing to him, but he will not do that, and that's very disturbing.
Well, not to quash a conspiracy theory, but why isn't he just being himself? You know, maybe this is the kind of guy he is. He's being himself. He's, you know, disciplined and maybe a little risk averse. And,
well,
you know,
discipline is not the same as letting it. They are knocking him. The president has called him all kinds of names. Yep. They've impugned his integrity. If he's so disciplined and full of probity, why doesn't he want to defend himself?
Well,
I think that we are a little bit upset because he is a very rare, high profile public figure who is infuriating both the left and the right. And why is he infuriating both the left and the right is because he did a thorough investigation. He provided facts, and those facts are open to interpretation from people on the right and people on the left. And I, for one, have a huge amount of respect for him that he is not taking a side. He is simply placing the facts out there and doing his job and not becoming
wrong. And the reason it's wrong is by not taking a side, he's taking a side. Look, it's the future of this country. We have a dangerous totalitarian demagogue in office right now, and he knows it. And he's tried to point the way, the breadcrumbs are there. But in fact, he has a responsibility in my mind.
I think that he looks at what has happened to James Comey, and in James Comey taking a side, he has lowered his stature. And I think that Mueller wants to keep his stature as and did his report. It is fact-based. He spent a lot of time. He had, I think, a couple dozen brilliant prosecutorial-minded attorneys interviewing people, going through documents, subpoenas. I mean, what they did is historic in putting together this document, and I think he's proud of it, and he wants to let that stand on its own and let the chips fall where they may. And if he takes a side, I think he just becomes another James Comey.
I agree with you, and I think we're the ones who made him a hero. Mm-hmm.
We're the ones who made him a hero.
We decided, you know, before he got the report out that he was going to be a hero and he was going to bust it open. And
that says more about us than about him.
We're culpable for that. But I agree with you, JP. I think he did a really thorough job. I think he didn't see his place as, you know, falling on one side or the other, but just doing the right legal thing. And I think that's what we got.
Well, JP, I've been talking to your cousin PJ on this very issue, and we think you're wrong. the fact of the matter is that he does have a greater responsibility. The future of this country is at stake right now, and he knows what a lot of Americans don't know, and he needs to be able to say it. And if it's too much like Comey, tough noogies.
Yeah, I don't know. I see. What difference could he make? I mean, he wouldn't. If he can, could it start impeachment proceedings? Then the Senate wouldn't impeach him anyway. So
wait a second now. If it's so specific, and if we learn material that we don't know yet, and it's in the face of those senators, just like it was with Nixon, the Republicans, they'll come around if it's so evident.
So you think that he might have information that he hasn't put in his
Absolutely.
Document?
Absolutely. I know he has that. How do I know? Your cousin told me.
Well, he probably does. I mean, any investigative reporter does not put everything in. You put only what's most provable. But for those that same reason, he's not going to spill it in this forum. That truly would be, that would be bad. His best material is in there. But I wanted explanatory things. Like one of the things that the right has said is, why did this investigation continue for so long? And I suspect the answer has to do with the thoroughness and the fairness and the and flushing out all of the legal avenues. That would be helpful to know. It would quiet those who say it was a conspiracy against Trump. It doesn't really make him partisan either way. He's defending his work. It seems to me the terms of this agreement are that he cannot talk about that. He can't talk about the deliberative process. He can't talk about any unindicted person, which includes Trump and Don Jr. and all the people we really are interested in.
I think it'll be interesting to hear the Republicans question him, because the Democrats are going to have their lines and their script. And the Republicans, though, are in a unique situation. If you remember, when they questioned Michael Cohen, they were sometimes asking him questions and then getting answers that they didn't want to get. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans are in a unique position. I think listening to their questions and the interactions with Mueller there could be more interesting than with the Democrats, which I assume Mueller is preparing for. He's going to know the 30 tough questions that they're going to ask and the 30 tough passages that they're going to pull out of the report, and he's going to have canned answers on what to say to those questions.
And if nobody has seen it, in the New York Times today, look at the 19 questions
that he has to be asked.
It's a fascinating article.
I heard a perspective that said, you know, the Republicans' questions are all going to be about reelecting Trump, right? What can they ask that sort of leads to stuff they can use in reelecting Trump? So I thought that was interesting as well.
All right, let's go on to a couple letters and then we'll move on to some other subjects. Janet writes, to Rosemary, I hardly think that chameleon is the term to describe Donald Trump. Chameleons employ grace and serenity when they change their colors. Trump is a fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants individual and a total hypocrite when he reserves course. I love that listeners are taking the defense of the chameleons.
Wait, I didn't say it.
Okay. Who did? Do we know who said it?
I don't know.
I think, if I remember correctly, Peter said chameleon, but he said it about Boris Johnson.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay. All right. We have people who are defending chameleons, and that should be noted.
They need to be defended, too.
Christopher says, hello, panel. Of course, there is bipartisanship about raising the debt. Both parties want to spend as much money as they can on the programs they are for. The Democrats caved and gave the Republicans everything they want, and vice versa. Also, the debt that the government takes from the banks is debt that could be used for mortgages, car loans, and everything else for us. Before the government... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, don't be so sure lines are drawn between the Republicans and the Democrats, for example, on defense. You know, as you know, I have the congressional corner and I talk to Joe on your show and I talk to all of these guys. And if you have a submarine base in your district or you have an army base in your district, you better believe you are for an increase or the stability in the war category. These guys, follow the needs of their districts, period.
Douglas writes, Alan is on scent.
I didn't know what that meant.
I thought it was maybe, but I thought it was a typo.
I thought it was that I was a skunk.
No, it says it's on scent and it really stinks. You may be right. This is the only way for them to get rid of Social Security when interest rates go up, and they will. The interest on the federal debt plus the defense budget will consume our entire federal income. Jeremy says, Dems don't get it. People are tired of hearing people called racist. They should have more accurately called his statement un-American. Republicans, I tend to agree with Steve Miller's uncle, who stated last night in an interview with Rachel Maddow that all these ethnic atrocities are being orchestrated by Republicans to rid our country of those people most likely to vote against them in coming years. Children are being abused for the very worst of reasons. They are evil personified.
Great letter.
Richard writes, Mueller spent years on investigating and reporting the facts. It is up to Congress, not Mueller, to take up the ball and run with it or not.
Yeah, there you go.
Saul says, and in the meantime, this is of trillions of dollars, and in the meantime, 3 million households are soon to be thrown off of food stamps because they work an extra shift. They're now going after the working poor. Russ says, to make a generalization, Trump's base voted for him because he stirred them emotionally. If they felt powerless and frustrated with the establishment, blaming it for what they're not happy about their lives as U.S. citizens, Trump is someone who speaks their language, even if his policies don't necessarily help them in the pocketbook. Jed writes this letter, why hasn't anyone learned about polling after 2016? Polling is like predicting the weather. Do you stand outside and put up your umbrella when the poll tells you to do so, or do you wait until the raindrops are falling upon you? What I do. How about you?
I just want to point out that Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes. So the pollsters weren't all wrong. It's just the distribution of those votes in those states. The pollsters should have caught that, but they didn't. But she still won the most votes by far.
She did win the most votes, but there were a lot of reasons a lot of the polls were wrong. And they varied from not having a very representative sample to people not giving true answers, to things like interpretation of the results not being statistically correct, to things like this election just looking really different from other elections that had been modeled. So, some of the models were legitimate, but they didn't give you they gave you the low probability answer.
As always, your answer is brilliant. I have to tell you, though.
But Fru and Gugu, right?
But there are some but there are some things.
But you love me anyway, right, Alan?
I very much love you. But there are some things that you don't tell your pollster, as you indicated in reason number 3, and you don't tell your mother. You just don't tell them. So when you look at the unification of the Republican folks who are so lined up behind Trump and the people who do not deviate from that position, I think it really does tell you an awful lot about the way this country is split.
Yeah,
and in addition to the Republicans, a lot of the blue collar Democrats in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota.
Does that hold up, JP?
Well,
in other words,
they've joined the Republicans. A lot of blue collar Democrats.
No question that you're right. That's what happened in the last election, presidential election. The question for me is whether those folks, as opposed to the Republicans, what's good for us in our pocketbooks, whether those folks know that they were taken in.
So, Alan, here's a fun fact about some of the election models. Some of the election models only talk to people with landlines. And if you think about people with landlines as being representative of the American population, they're really not anymore. People have cell phones, and many people don't use their landlines. And, so there are all kinds of kind of funky reasons weren't accurate.
You're right. I have to tell you, though, every time I talk to a pollster these days, they tell me that they've got a handle on the cell phones, they know how to do that.
That's a good thing. Yeah. I mean, that's a more accurate thing. It didn't necessarily happen all the time in 2016, but that's smart.
All right. We just have about a minute and a half. And I do want to, why don't we just end with the fast track deportations, the Trump administration to expand its power to deport undocumented immigrants. The Trump administration will significantly expand its power to quickly deport undocumented immigrants who have illegally entered the United States within the past 2 years using a fast track deportation process that bypasses immigration judges. How can that be legal?
Well, it possibly isn't, and there are already groups who are vowing to take it to court, but he's instituting it right away. He's skipped through all of the hearings and things that you normally need in a rule change like this. So some people will definitely be affected, and I think maybe the biggest hope is that when you put into place an operation like this by people who are very biased and, under the gun, there will be mistakes, and that will help the court cases.
But doesn't it expand a rule that's already there? So the rule that's already there typically looked at people in the first few weeks and within 100 miles of the border, and it changes that 100 miles,
correct,
and it changes that first few weeks, right?
Correct. Correct.
So there was some sort of a
rule, and you can see what's happening. Administration lawyers are going through all the existing rules and then pressing it to the outer limit. It's like, okay, what can we do that's within this limit? And they'll say that Obama put this rule. Right. It was actually Bush who put this
Clinton
rule.
And Bush,
Clinton and Bush. Clinton and Bush. It goes back a ways, and now they're pushing it further. So again, the way it's implemented now will be really interesting. It's gonna it's gonna make up the cases that will end up being adjudicated.
Yeah.
But you know, it's part of their ongoing pledge to deport millions of people.
And by the way, it's horrendous. And if you couple with this with the story we saw a few weeks ago about people using driver's license databases in the states where aliens can get driver's license and using that to hunt people down, it's pretty darn scary.
Yep.
You bet.
All right, we're out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us. Alan, J.P. Miller, Fran Berman, Rosemary Armeo, thank you all for being here. Peter Maloney, thank you very much for being our special guest this morning. A delight to have you here. Thank you,
pleasure,
as always. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.